It was a big day last week when Lisa Monaco had a lot to say. What she said that we were all listening for was that she was talking about going back to the days of the Wild West and putting up wanted posters, seeking whistleblowers to come in and help DOJ criminal to provide them with information about serious financial crimes and foreign and domestic corruption.
That was Mary Inman. This is Tom Fox. On this episode, Barry takes us through the DOJ announcement of a financial incentive program for whistleblowers. We're joined by Jonathan Marks, Jonathan Armstrong, and Matt Kelly in this exploration. First, a word from this month's sponsor of the Compliance Podcast Network, Ethico.
Cases based on your unique criteria, we turn the maze into a clear path forward. Envision a compliance process that's not just effective, but also intuitive and adaptable to your needs. It's time to redefine efficiency in your workplace. Embark on this journey of transformation at ethico.com/CPN. Book a demo, read our white paper by Tom Fox titled The ROI of Compliance, and try our free ROI calculator to discover a world of seamless compliance management.
First thing I want to say as a San Franciscan is that all of these initiatives that we've been talking about came out of the White Collar Crime Conference that was held in San Francisco. So anyone who's saying San Francisco isn't relevant anymore and that we're in trouble, we're still relevant. We're still cool. So with that framing from my hometown, it was a big day last week when Lisa Monaco had a lot to say. What she said that we were all listening for was that she was talking about going back to the days of the Wild West and putting up wanted posters, seeking whistleblowers to come in and help DOJ criminal to provide them with information about serious financial crimes and foreign and domestic corruption. That's a big deal. What do I think is really going on here? I think the DOJ criminal is having FOMO. So we know that the SEC, the CFTC, the IRS, FinCEN with the Treasury Department, and even the Department of Transportation have whistleblower reward programs. So I think DOJ criminal is realizing when you look at the billions that have been recovered under the SEC program for Dodd-Frank for whistleblowers, I think they're recognizing that they may be missing out on a real opportunity. What did they say? They told us, Lisa said, that they are starting a 90-day process where they want to take comments about the idea of inviting whistleblowers to bring them information, as I said earlier, about serious financial crimes and foreign and domestic corruption. Just because they've given us 90 days to all start weighing in on the parameters, it doesn't mean those of us on the plaintiff side haven't already started to talk to DOJ about potential angles. The first thing let's talk about a little bit is eligibility. So what Lisa has said is that they will be considering rewards to people who voluntarily provide truthful information not already known to DOJ. It will only apply to whistleblowers that are not eligible for financial incentives under any of these other programs, and that they expect to launch it before the end of 2024. I think it would be helpful to put some meat on the bones since we're talking about how does this fit in, this program fit in a very noisy space where there are lots of other rewards, right? So they're just saying, where does this apply where other programs leave off? And I think that really is, and some of the things she, Lisa, discussed was, for instance, FCPA cases. So the FCPA, the SC has jurisdiction to enforce the FCPA, but really only as to issuers. So I have had lots of whistleblowers bring me potential FCPA cases, but because they're non-issuers, I can't get the SEC to act. And if I can't get the SEC to act, then our clients are not entitled to a reward. And a lot of people won't come forward. It's not just because people are obviously incentivized by the money, but obviously when you put yourself at risk, which you would be doing here under the new DOJ criminal program, because you're talking about corporate crime, the risks to your career can be very high. I would say that those are some areas. Interestingly, domestic corruption. So it's not just foreign bribery of foreign government officials. She signaled that domestic corruption. We've seen with certain senators from New Jersey and other places that we have domestic corruption, and they would welcome that kind of information. Finally, another big space where I feel like the SEC leaves a hole is that their mandate is to protect the capital markets, and really their mission is directed at protecting Main Street investors. So often they won't go after the private companies, private, non-publicly listed companies. So I would think about Theranos as an example. I've had the great pleasure of representing Tyler Schultz, one of the Theranos whistleblowers, and it's a rare example of the SEC actually going after a private company. And I think it's just because it was such an extraordinarily brazen fraud. So I think you're going to see more of those kinds of cases, us being able to bring those to DOJ. So it does feel like a very watershed moment in terms of expanding who can bring information, and it's going to really hoover up a lot of the areas where whistleblowers have fallen between the cracks. So it's very exciting for us. I want to end by talking about, in the spirit of this 90-day, they're looking for feedback. Here's some feedback that I would provide to DOJ. What is needed? A couple of the things that were said were, there are a couple of things that were omitted. I think what's really vital for this program is that they establish a floor of guaranteed minimum payments that a whistleblower would receive, because without a floor and assurance that there would be some payment, it's typically the floor in other programs is 10%. You're not going to get whistleblowers to undertake those risks. I think it's really important that they create an office of the whistleblower. Otherwise, it's very difficult for whistleblowers to know where to go. So they should take a page from the SEC's book, create an office of the whistleblower as a central clearinghouse that's staffed to accept all of these complaints. Finally, I think they really need to talk about what confidentiality and anonymity looks like. The SEC program, which, as you can see, I think is the gold standard in this space, does allow for anonymous reporting. And I think that's also something that's going to be very important here. A couple of things I want to quibble with of how Lisa's suggesting that they would design the program is that they would exclude culpable whistleblowers from being eligible. My view, and that's certainly the view of the False Claims Act and the Founding Fathers, because the False Claims Act came during the Civil War, is that it takes a rogue to catch a rogue. So if you're excluding culpable whistleblowers, you're excluding a huge source of information. I'm not saying that you should be the architect of the fraud and thereby create a fraud and benefit from it. The False Claims Act has ways where we exclude whistleblowers who are the planners and initiators of the fraud. But I think you can get, she would be by definition, as she's describing it now, excluding some people who may technically be culpable, but it certainly wasn't their idea and they're the bag men and women carrying out the fraud. Finally, the program is supposed to be limited to people who are bringing non-public information. I think that's also a limitation that's unnecessary. We've seen under the SEC program, people called, we like to call whistleblower outsiders, bringing information that is equally as valuable. So we've seen competitors and other folks with information that the DOJ would be excluding here. So that is my sense on this program and what to expect, but it's very welcome news. And the last thing I'll say is that even before DOJ Criminal put out their announcement last week, SDNY was the one who started with its own discussion of a whistleblower reward program. And then the Northern District of California also launched one. So I think we're setting off within DOJ certainly a race to which districts can have a whistleblower program. I would love to kick it to my fabulous co-panelists, what they think about, what does this mean for prosecutions when you have a whistleblower as a financial incentive? Is this going to hurt the people's credibility? And I guess I'd also like to kick it off to my co-panelists on what is this going to mean? Will this incentivize more voluntary self-disclosure by companies now that they know that they've got this risk? Are we going to see more voluntary self-disclosures as a result of the fear that they better come in first before the whistleblower makes the government aware?
Matt, I'm going to pitch to you first, then over to Mr. Marks.
So I had a question for you, Mary, more that do you have any insights into or speculation about the circumstances where compliance officers themselves could be the whistleblowers? For example, I know that in the SC, yes, you can, if you have first tried to bring the matter forward internally and they took no action. Although, on the other hand, my read of the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020 is that no, compliance officers don't need to do that. The AML Act just says if you know of misconduct and you want to report it, you're eligible for an award. And Lisa Monaco, in her speech, basically said to an audience of lawyers, you may encounter misconduct and then you might have an avenue to report it. Like, my take is that, yes, compliance officers probably could be eligible, but what do you think?
It's a great question. My views on this are that as we've watched these programs come in time, they are evolving. As you are absolutely right, the SEC program says that unless there are exceptional circumstances, both compliance officers and people with internal audit functions cannot be eligible for a reward unless they report internally first and they wait 120 days. And there's all of these sort of governors placed on it. What came next is the Treasury FinCEN program that you're alluding to, which is both for money laundering and now for sanctions violations. Yes, that program removed that and said, we take all comers, including compliance officers and folks with internal audit functions. And so I think that's what you're going to expect here with this program. I think that's the more evolved view. So that's my two cents.
Mr. Marks.
Mary, very great insights that you provided to the listeners. So thank you for that. I just had a couple things real quick. One is, I've been barking about this for a long time. If a compliance officer or chief audit executive resigns or there's a noisy withdrawal, there should be a noisy withdrawal, it should be an AK event and everybody should know about it, because I think there's got to be some reason behind that. And then the other thing that I wanted to bring up too was, Tom, your comments with regard to why is a triage or investigation program and why getting to answers more quickly appropriate, it's for that very reason. You're putting these programs in place. You don't want individuals running to the government. You want to have a compliance program that works and that where you can contain that, because when they start to go outside, then all of a sudden people think that they can leapfrog all the process and procedure. And so that's why I think that a lot of focus and attention need to come into play here with regard to those. It's interesting. There was a study that I read at the beginning of the week about audit committees and their focus on certain things, and fraud prevention was dissed. Cybersecurity was up there. Enterprise risk management was up there. I think it was the center of audit quality, but fraud detection and prevention was shuffled to the side. I think we really need to go back fundamentally based on all of this and really look at the overall fraud risk management program, which really means it's not only designing those internal controls, but it really is when an allegation is made and it starts to come through our system, how does that get processed and how does that get treated? Otherwise, a lot of what you're seeing here, this new DOJ program is fantastic. Why have a compliance program then? If your compliance program is, we're spending all this money on compliance program, it should work. Well, then let's make it work.
Mr. Armstrong, thoughts from across the pond?
Yeah, I know Mary knows this more than anyone, but just to recap one of the topics we discussed on an earlier call, of course, the whole whistleblower thing is international. Nick F. Graves said in his speech when he was talking about bounties in the UK that 700 UK whistleblowers had gone to the US authorities instead. And it's like that old joke, which I won't repeat on such an erudite channel as this, the punchline of which is, we've established what you are, but now we're just haggling over the money. And and that's the case, I think, with these whistleblower programs. So I think other governments will try and put mirror bounty programs in place. But my suspicion is there isn't the political will to give the same big numbers to people. And as a result, I think the US will remain the dominant player in incentivizing whistleblowers.
I'm sorry to bring us to a somber note, but what has been big news this week, of course, has been what it seems to be an apparent suicide by one of the Boeing 737 whistleblowers, a man by the name of John Barnett. My rant is that it needs to change, that we have very few resources in the mental health space for whistleblowers and also for their attorneys. It was not lost on me that this suicide, apparent suicide, happened in the midst of Mr. Barnett being in back-to-back deposition, days of deposition. And I think that it's incumbent on lawyers and other people who are the first to deal with whistleblowers to really take a hard look about the type of trauma-informed, humanitarian-type, humanistic-type approaches we should be thinking about when we deal with whistleblowers. It's all too often that whistleblowers speak out in the public interest on behalf of all of us, on behalf of the safety of the flying public, but we don't put enough of a safety net beneath and behind them. And I feel like this is a wake-up call for us all to do that.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, our network sponsor for this month is Ethoco. I have partnered with Ethoco to help you figure out the ROI of your compliance program. I've written a white paper on that that's available at the website listed in the show notes. And Ethoco has developed an ROI calculator to help you determine the ROI of your compliance program. I hope you will check out both of these items this month. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope you'll subscribe, rate, and review wherever great podcasts are listened to. The award-winning FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.